Welcome, I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, who returns tomorrow. This is Your Call. May 1st, also known as International Workers' Day, has become an occasion to highlight the plight and the power of working people across the globe. In the U.S. today, activists and working people are marking the day by participating in street protests, marches, work stoppages to bring attention to lack of workplace rights and the economic struggles of working families. This year, in the Bay Area and across the country, they're also gearing up for what organizers have called a day without immigrants, denouncing Donald Trump's anti-immigrant rhetoric and his policies. According to news reports, there are several demonstrations and strikes planned across the Bay Area, including a shutdown of the Port of Oakland, employee walkouts at some of Silicon Valley's tech giants, and at dozens of schools. In his new book, Beyond 15, Immigrant Workers, Faith Activists, and the Revival of the Labor Movement, veteran labor and community organizer Jonathan Rosenblum explores questions of workers and power and the power of business and politics by focusing on the successful campaign for a $15 minimum wage that took root at the Seattle-Tacoma International Airport and went on to spark a renewal in the U.S. labor movement around the country. Jonathan Rosenblum says we need to build a new labor movement, one that is unafraid to talk about power and class and whose scope of engagement spans the broader struggles for social justice, civil rights, and democracy, along with economic rights. Jonathan Rosenblum is a union and community organizer living in Seattle. He was also the campaign director for the SeaTac Workers Organizing Campaign back in 2011, and his new book is Beyond 15, Immigrant Workers, Faith Activists, and the Revival of the Labor Movement. Jonathan, thanks so much for joining us on Your Call this morning. Morning.
Matt, thank you very much for having me, and a happy May Day to all of your listeners.
Oh, great. And I want to let folks know that Jonathan will be here in the Bay Area on Thursday, May 11th. He is going to be coming to the UC Berkeley Labor Center on that date, May 11th at 6 p.m. He'll be talking about his book and, of course, engaging in conversation. If you want more details, you can go to our website, yourcallradio.com. So, Jonathan, Seattle is a place where already on national news we're hearing about protests here on May Day. What do you know about what's going on? And also, where would you be right now if you weren't in a radio studio talking to us?
Well, if I weren't here, I would be gathering with my sisters and brothers at a park. We're going to have a march of thousands, maybe tens of thousands of workers led by the immigrant community here in Seattle through the downtown area. There'll be a cultural celebration afterwards, a lot of speeches, and a lot of, celebration of 100 days of resistance and many more to come.
Yeah, how do you see? I mean, this is obviously a really remarkable moment, more protest in these first few months of the Trump administration than we've seen in quite a while in the United States. And I'm just interested, since your book and your work is so much about bringing these questions of workers' struggles together with broader social movements, and when I say broad, I don't really mean broad, I mean other social movements. What do you see as the role that labor is playing right now in entering this political moment, and what should they be doing?
Well, I'd say there's more than one answer to it. First of all, we see a lot of unions and union leaders stepping up and realizing that unions need to play a broader role in building this vibrant new labor movement. And we see some unions that are trying to hunker down and figure out what they can get in the next few years. And we have to obviously resist that narrow approach. But I'd say at the rank and file level, we have a lot of workers who are realizing that now is the time to stand up. While we won't be having the kind of strikes that you talked about in the lead-in to the show here in Seattle, there's a lot of ferment, and there have been some school walkouts in the last few weeks. There have been some episodic strikes, and today we'll be recommitting ourselves to even more activity in the coming months and years.
Well, Jonathan, on this May Day, I want to invite our listeners to take part in the conversation. The number where you can call is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. We're talking about organized labor from the workplace outward into our broader economy and politics, the role that it's playing or not playing in current social movements, and wanting to hear from you about the view from where you work. Do you feel like you have power in your workplace now compared to what you did 5 or 10 years ago? And if you're one of the people who's out joining many of the protests planned for today, do you think of workers' rights and economic issues, the balance of power between business and workers, as part of your agenda? How are you seeing this play out? Give us a call at 866-798-8255. 8255. And you can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. So Jonathan Rosenblum, your new book, Beyond 15, really starts with one example of workers organizing that then really has this kind of radiating power outward. But what's really cool is because you were a former journalist, you became a labor organizer, you were working in Seattle at this time when there was a need for workers working at SeaTac, the Seattle airport. Of course, a lot of people here have probably flown into SeaTac at some point. But talk about, I mean, what was really cool in the book is that you make it clear how the changes that took place in the airline industry and at SeaTac in particular kind of mirror some larger changes in the economy. So maybe you just start by talking about what was changing there and why there was a need for organizing.
That's right, Matt. When we began working in a significant way on organizing these low-wage workers at SeaTac International Airport in 2011, the number 15 wasn't even on our minds. What we knew is that we had 4,000 low-wage workers at the airport who were stuck in this cycle of one poverty wage job after another, cabin cleaners, wheelchair attendants, fuelers, janitors, and so on. And the reason why these were poverty wage jobs is because back in the late 70s, under the Carter administration, a Democratic Congress passed and President Carter signed legislation that enabled airlines to deregulate. And it also created new bankruptcy laws that allowed corporations to step away from pension agreements they had made with unions in the years past and other obligations. And what we saw beginning shortly after 78 is the destruction of good family wage jobs in airports around the country. And this was accelerated after 9/11 when airlines used the cover of national crisis, airline executives used the cover of national crisis to bust unions, contract out work, and get out of pension and wage obligations that they had. Hundreds of thousands of airport and airline workers lost their jobs, lost their good wages, lost their pensions, and so on. And so when we began engaging with workers at SeaTac in 2011, we found this was the situation that they were in, along with brothers and sisters around the country.
And talk one really valuable thing about your book is you do actually tell the stories of some people and how their lives changed as these changes happened at SeaTac, and then how they got involved in organizing. Maybe talk for a moment about Alex Hoops.
So Alex Hoops was, if you could distill what happened to airline workers and airport workers in this country into a single individual, you'd come up with somebody like Alex. Here's a young man who goes to work for Alaska Airlines, our largest carrier here at SeaTac, in 1989, and he's a ramper, he's a baggage handler, and he works year in and year out and gets up to $21 an hour by 2005. He's got a pension, he's got benefits, he's got vacation time, he's got a decent job. Now, $21 an hour at that time doesn't enable you to live in a luxury house or anything, but you can make it. You can go back to school. You can have a social life and so on. And he was living a decent life. In 2005, Alaska Airlines decided to fire nearly 500 baggage handlers, including Alex, at the airport, and they contracted out the work to a company that paid workers minimum wage. So what happened to Alex is he went from this decent life to all of a sudden being paid minimum wage. And Alex was key in this campaign. When he got involved, he started knocking on the doors of local businesses saying, you know, I used to shop here. I used to eat food here. I used to buy my stuff here. I can't afford to do it anymore. So when I get a raise, it's going to actually help your business out a little bit. And Alex also talked to his coworkers and said, you know, life doesn't have to be this way. I remember when we had decent paying jobs here. And so through the course of the campaign, Alex played a key role in mobilizing the community. Now, today, he's working as a baggage handler at the airport, and he's making over $16 an hour. And we can celebrate the fact that as a result of the work that we did, he went from about $9.50 to $16 an hour in one fell swoop. And that's worth celebrating. But it's also important to remember the context of this, that if Alaska hadn't fired him and his coworkers in 2005, he'd be making a lot more money. So we should absolutely celebrate victories, wage victories like $15 victories. But let's remember that it's only a drop in terms of what capital has stolen from workers over the last generation.
I think when a lot of people think about outsourcing, they imagine your jobs going abroad. And that's what's actually quite interesting hearing these stories. These are obviously jobs – you can't move baggage handling to another country, right? It has to happen where people are getting on and off the plane. But there's this whole process that's gone on in the airline industry of basically – sometimes even with wholly owned subsidiaries of the already existing airlines to do that same work.
That's right. Airlines have perfected this shell game of where they'll set up another company and then contract the work out to that company, which they still control, but that enables them to escape laws and that enables them to lower standards. And I'd say even more insidiously, it allows them to keep workers on tenterhooks all the time, because you never know if you start organizing with your coworkers, the airline will come in and bring in a new contractor on 30 days' notice. So nobody has any real rights at work under this business scheme that the airlines have perfected. And I might add, we're seeing this in other industries as well.
And I want to – so one of the things on this May Day, when so many people are talking about the role of immigrant labor in our economy, talking about what would a day without an immigrant be like, I also want to talk about, obviously, very important – some of the stories of some of the immigrant workers that you have in your book, Beyond 15, talking about the organizing work at SeaTac. Maybe you could talk about Abdi Nasser Muhammad.
Well, Abdi Muhammad is a good friend of mine, and he came to this country from Somalia originally, had been in several countries in Africa, was actually an organizer for the ANC youth against child labor policies in several African countries. He came here to this country, and he hadn't expected to see the sort of poverty that he witnessed when he first landed in New York City. He was just amazed by it. He thought that, you know, this was the land of where people realized their dreams, and yet he saw homeless people on the streets all over. He came out here, he started working at Bank of America, and the bank really liked him because he could speak five African languages, and in the growing Southeast Seattle community of African immigrants, he was a great asset to the bank, but he was paid poverty wages by the bank. And one day he left his job at the bank, walked out the door, and right into a protest that Working Washington, which is an offshoot of the Service Employees Union, and other allies were holding against the foreclosures that the bank was imposing on the community. And Abdi thought, well, you know, this seems like the right thing to do. So he joined in on the protest. And over the course of the 3 years of the SeaTac campaign, we worked very closely together on connecting the community to union members and building this broad movement.
And you talk in the book about the importance of trying to build trust at a, you know, very local level in the workplace, you know, between union organizers and workers, but also obviously there's challenges between different groups of workers, people with different experiences and backgrounds. Talk about what you kind of learned from that process and what you see are the real lessons for how organizing can happen.
I think the lesson, Matt, is that unions have to fight for a broad social and economic justice agenda and not just focus on the things that we traditionally see as part of union contracts. And one of the things that very few people know is that the SeaTac campaign only gained momentum when unions decided to throw down on an issue that had absolutely nothing to do with wages. In 2011, a group of Somali workers who worked for Hertz Rent-A-Car, who happened to belong to a union, one of the very few unions at the airport, started getting suspended for exercising their right to pray. And as you know, praying is one of the five pillars of Islam. It's something that workers for years had traditionally been able to do at Hertz: take a brief break to go pray and then come back to work, just like a bathroom break or a smoke break. But one day Hertz decided, we're going to start suspending people. And they did that. Now, the union, knowing that we live in an environment where Islamophobia is very sharp and pervasive, the union could have simply taken the approach of, let's file a grievance and try to deal with it that way. But instead, they did something that in hindsight was remarkable and changed the whole trajectory of the campaign. The union reached out to the Muslim community and the Christian community, Jewish community, and said, we're going to hold a multi-faith prayer vigil outside of the Hertz ticket counter. And they did that, and the leadership of the union went on CNN nationally with her shop steward. They talked about the religious discrimination. And what the leader of the union, Tracy Thompson, said is, this isn't just about the right of Muslim workers to pray. This is about union rights, because if they come after this group of workers and say, you can't take a break to do something you've traditionally been able to do, then they'll come after all of our rights eventually. So we have to see this as an attack on all workers. That really transformed the relationship between the Muslim community and the unions in this SeaTac area. And it built the trust that had not existed up until then. When imams and others in the community saw that the unions were reaching out and taking risks and engaging on this religious justice issue, they began to see that, yes, the union is about all of us. It's not just about some of us. And as it turns out, Muslims were the single largest ethnic group, or I'd say Somali Muslims were the single largest ethnic group at the airport. And so when they began to get involved as a result of this transformative event, other workers also began to see momentum, and they stepped up as well.
That's the voice of Jonathan Rosenblum. He is our guest today on Your Call. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, who will be back tomorrow. Jonathan's new book is Beyond 15, Immigrant Workers, Faith Activists, and the Revival of the Labor Movement, which starts with this story of workers at SeaTac organizing that Jonathan was directly involved in, but then talking about how it grew into something greater, the Fight for 15 that now is really something people know nationally, certainly has had an impact not only in Seattle but in the Bay Area, started with this work, and that's where we're talking to him. We invite your calls with questions, comments, ideas. They could be specifically around the Fight for 15 or about protests you're involved in on this May Day, how you think there is that connection between broader social movements and economic rights that unions and organized labor organize on behalf of. The number to call, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Talk. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or post on our website, yourcallradio.org. Jonathan, so you talk about, so here was this kind of surprising issue that then caused this broader sense of solidarity. How then did that go from that to making a decision to get out of the kind of workplace organizing level of things to say, let's push for a $15 minimum wage that would be for everyone?
Well, we looked at the legal landscape, which actually bars workers from forming individual bargaining units at the airport and negotiating with their employers. And it doesn't bar it. It actually allows employers to not recognize that. And so workers formed unions nonetheless at all the major contractors at the airport. And in March of 2013, delegations of workers and faith leaders and community activists went to all the different management offices of the contractors. And we also went to the headquarters of Alaska Airlines, which is right outside the airport, and we said, we have formed unions. We ask that you agree to recognize these unions and sit down and bargain with us. Now, we knew at the outset there was a very slim likelihood that the companies would say yes. And as it turns out, they all rejected out of hand the call for recognition of the union and bargaining. And we said, essentially, fine. If you're not going to agree to sit down with us and bargain, then we will go to the voters and have the voters impose a solution on you. And that's exactly what happened. What led to SeaTac Proposition 1 was us saying, fine, you didn't want to bargain, we'll have the voters impose it. And it wasn't just $15. It was 15 paid sick leave, protection for people who received tips to make sure that they received all the tips, full-time work for those who wanted it, because many of these jobs were 20-hour week positions, and the employers would not hire people for more, and they just hire more and more people as part-time positions. And it also provided for job security, so that if the airline decided to change contractors, the new contractor had to hire the existing workforce. We also included strong enforcement protection, giving workers and their organizations the right to go to court to sue an employer who is not complying with the law. The Seattle Times editorial board, which was obviously very hostile to us, called it a virtual union contract and urged a no vote. And I certainly couldn't dispute their characterization.
And when you say you wouldn't dispute, you like that we actually made the demands we wanted, we put them into a proposition.
Absolutely. And then we had a pitch battle between really us, unions, community groups, faith organizations on one side, and on the other side, the Chamber of Commerce, the hotel industry, the airline industry, parking lot industry, and virtually every business, large business in and around SeaTac opposed us. And we won the initiative by 77 votes.
Talk about the role. You mentioned faith leaders in this and people who organize from religious communities. Talk about the importance of what they did. And also, I mean, you in the book, Beyond 15, you talk a bit about how, you know, how it makes sense to how to bring in that perspective and to put a moral basis to what you're arguing for without kind of using it as a means to an end.
That's right, Matt. And let me just say, first of all, what we usually do, those of us who come out of union organizing, is we usually, historically, we ask faith leaders to get involved in the campaign, to come to press conferences, to show up, to do things, but we really don't ask them to be co-creators of the movement. We don't ask them to be strategists. So we say, can you show up to a press conference, provide us some validation because you have credibility in the community, and then we say goodbye after they've read their lines. In SeaTac, we took a fundamentally different approach. We said, because the workers don't see the workplace as being the sole place of struggle, and because they're so tied into the community, to their mosques, to their churches, to their community networks, we have to build this as a community-wide network, and everybody's going to be involved in this union-building project. And so when we sat down to design strategy, we sat down with faith leaders, we sat down with people in the community, and we said, here's an opportunity coming up. What do you think we should do, and how should we do it?
And so what did they add from your perspective? I mean, obviously there's just the part of they're bought in because they're part of the process before you're, you know, doing the press conference. But what did you see as what did they add to what you as an organizer might have otherwise brought to the situation?
Well, as the initiative was becoming public, we had this opportunity with the 2013 Alaska Airlines shareholders meeting. Mm. And a number of us over the months leading up to the shareholders meeting had bought shares so that we could actually gain entry into the meeting. And we sat down with the faith leaders and asked them what they thought we should do. And they came up with this idea of opening the meeting with a prayer for worker justice. And that's exactly what we did. So imagine, if you will, this auditorium of 200, 250 shareholders, several dozen of them being workers and organizers and community allies. And 5 minutes before it's supposed to begin, these 12 clergy get up to the front of the auditorium, and one of them says, I've been asked by some shareholders to lead a prayer. Now, they were so deft about this that even the executives thought that this was part of the program. And the minister who led this, John Helmier, who's about 6'7" and certainly commands attention, said, you know, God grant us, power to do the right thing. And he sort of drew everyone in, and then he started talking about worker justice and let's not be greedy and let's take care of workers in the community. And it stunned the executives into silence. In addition, it also empowered the workers who were there to feel like this wasn't just an economic struggle. This was a struggle about basic values. This was a struggle about whether this company had lost its moral compass, and we were there to hold them accountable and to demand justice for workers. And so throughout the course of the shareholders meeting, then workers stood up, challenged the CEO very boldly, sang songs, did skits, and so on. We really, I have to say, disrupted that meeting in a huge way. And it started because the faith leaders came up with this idea of shifting the fight from an economic argument to one about morality.
That's the voice of Jonathan Rosenblum, longtime union and community organizer. He has a new book, Beyond 15, Immigrant Workers, Faith Activists, and the Revival of the Labor Movement, that talks about the beginnings of the Fight for 15 movement at the SeaTac International Airport outside Seattle, which, of course, spread to Seattle and other cities around the country, including here in the Bay Area. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar here on Your Call. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a moment.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's toll-free, 866-798-TALK. And you can post a comment or a question at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. 40-hour work week and paid sick leave are benefits that many in today's work workforce expect and take for granted. Organized labor is to thank for these and other hard-won protections, yet only 1 in 10 American workers are unionized. That and more discussed tonight at 7 p.m. on City Visions here on 91.7 KALW. Time now is 10:31.
I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. You can find more information about the program at yourcallradio.org. You can listen to past shows there and also subscribe to our podcast. And if you ever have a show idea for us, feel free to drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are marking May Day by talking with Seattle-based union and community organizer Jonathan Rosenblum. He was the campaign director for the SeaTac Workers Organizing Campaign back in 2011 and the author of the new book, Beyond 15, Immigrant Workers, Faith Activists, and the Revival of the Labor Movement. Do want to let folks know that Jonathan is going to be in the Bay Area on Thursday, May 11th. He'll be speaking at the UC Berkeley Labor Center at 6 p.m. You can find the details at our website, yourcallradio.org. Jonathan, right now when it comes, I think that obviously a lot of conversation about economic inequality, since the Occupy movement, 99%, that entire push, I think that's kind of changed the consciousness about economic inequality. And certainly in our most recent national election, the tensions and the fears that people have around the gap between rich and poor, people's sense of not having security in their jobs, really came to the fore. But a lot of the debate has really centered on blue state versus red state, urban, rural, immigrant versus native born. And I'm interested, you've been someone who's really done organizing that crosses boundaries. How do you think that we can, defeat that kind of divisive narrative, which certainly for the purposes of workers trying to organize for their rights is really problematic?
Well, there's nothing new, of course, Matt, with the establishment media and their political allies trying to divide working people in any number of ways, as you've just mentioned a number of categories. And I think that we have to break that narrative and say that this is about all of us, no matter where you work, no matter where you live, no matter where you came from. And I think we have to go beyond, though, this dissection of economic inequality as being the problem that we have in this country. There's an intentionality to my book title, Beyond 15, that challenges the notion that we have to just fight on economics. It's true, income inequality is a huge problem in our country and indeed throughout the world today, but it's a symptom of the underlying problem that we have of power inequality. And we need a movement that very consciously goes beyond addressing just the symptoms of this power inequality, inequality in housing, inequality in wages, inequality in civil rights, and so on, and tackles the root causes of inequity, that is, power. And how do working people gather up power?
I think one of the kind of important narratives for making people, in a lot of ways, kind of accept whatever those imbalances of power is, and I think this certainly is true in Seattle, also here in the Bay Area, is kind of a conversation about, well, we've got a new economy. Right. There's, look, here's technology. It's really booming. It's creating all these different opportunities. And I think the idea is like, well, those working class jobs that used to pay well, used to have the benefits, it's understandable that those are going to be on the wane. That's not where the future of the economy lies. How do you challenge or question that narrative?
Well, I think there certainly are different forms of production and distribution in our 21st century economy. There's no question about it. But there's also no question that there's an unchanging truth, which is that the brain and muscle power of workers produces 100% of the wealth in this economy. And it's organized differently. It's not 30,000 people working under one roof producing steel. It may be 30,000 workers working in dispersed environments. Maybe many of them are independent contractors, misclassified probably, maybe working in different cities and so on. But we have to figure out how we bring together workers who share these common interests, common employers, and build power. So the form of economic production and distribution makes it more challenging for us. But the unchanging truth is that it's workers who produce the wealth in this country. And so we have to figure out, how do we collectivize worker action to exert our influence over the employers?
Jonathan, I want to invite our listeners to join the conversation at 866-798-8255. Wherever you are located in the economy, wherever you work, we'd love to hear from you. Particularly interested in folks who may have worked on getting a minimum wage hike here in the Bay Area. If you're someone who perhaps works at San Francisco Airport and has some comparable stories to tell to what Jonathan has told about SeaTac, or you're one of the folks out marching today for immigrants and their rights in the workplace, the number to call, 866-798-8255. And we have a couple of folks on the line. Christopher in San Francisco, welcome to your call.
Hi, Matt, and thanks for the show today, and the book sounds excellent. Great work. I just wanted to mention, I'm a local journalist and writer, and I've been covering the Trump administration's labor rollback agenda, which I think is a really important piece of the conversation, especially on Workers' Day, but especially going forward now. And it's a really dramatic, radical rollback of workers' rights and job safety protections. He's been repealing overtime protections that could cover up to 13 million American workers, and trying to destroy job safety training programs and employment training programs. And so it's a really massive assault on unions and workers' rights that I think needs to be part of the conversation. And if I could quickly mention that one article I wrote for The Progressive that people can look up if they're interested is called Trumping Labor in The Progressive magazine. But there's a lot more to say about that.
Thank you, Christopher. We'll post that on the website. But, of course, Jonathan, love to hear you on this.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely necessary that we call Trump out for what he's done and what he's thinking about doing. But I think that we really have to take a longer view of things, that the problem really isn't Trump. The problem is the neoliberal consensus that we've had in the political establishment, not just over the last 100 days, but over the last several decades. So you have these attacks on workers that have happened under Democratic administrations, under Republican administrations, and so on. I think it's important, just by way of one example, that in early 2009, many of us had tremendous hope that Obama would really turn things around. And millions of working people were losing their homes and losing their jobs at the time. And what happened? Obama bailed out Wall Street and he forgot Main Street. During the 8 years of the Obama administration, we had some victories to be sure, but let's also remember that we lost 500,000 union members during that time, and that Obama's pledge to enact labor law reform fell flat, not because there wasn't support for it, but because he was unwilling to spend the political capital to see it through Congress. And so I think we have to recall that this isn't just about who happens to be in the White House. It's our responsibility to think about how are we building power among working people today, because that's ultimately what's going to win, no matter who is in the White House.
And I guess, Mike, when you're talking about Obama and this kind of, you know, the way that actually what you'd expected of a Democratic president coming in not actually coming true for unions. How do you think? I mean, you were talking earlier about faith leaders often being used by union organizers, like, oh, well, you know, come in for the press conference. I think there's probably people who think similar to about how the Democratic Party as a whole often uses organized labor. Says, oh, you know, when we need to turn people out for an event or it's time for get out the vote, then let's bring labor in. How do you think about how labor can hold the Democratic Party more accountable?
Well, I would change the question. I would say, right, how can we build an independent working class party that represents our interests? Because the Democratic Party, in spite of the fact that there are many good people at the local level, people I work with every day, there are people who get elected who are good. A lot of us have been inspired by people like Bernie Sanders. The truth is that the Democratic Party is a dead end for working people in this country today. In spite of the fact that we can see gains, more gains under a Democratic administration than a Republican administration, we have to remember what happened in 2009. We have to remember who was pushing TPP and who pushed NAFTA through, right? It was a Democratic administration that did those things to working people. And so while it's important to engage and contest issues within the party, it's actually more important, I believe, that we figure out how we build a working class party in this country today. And this takes many different forms depending on the city that you're in. But the sooner we realize the need to have our own independent politics, the better.
Jonathan Rosenblum is author of Beyond 15, Immigrant Workers, Faith Activists, and the Revival of the Labor Movement. This is Your Call. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, who will return tomorrow. And we are taking your calls at 866-798-8255 on this May Day, 866-798-TALK. And we have a caller, Tom, on the line. Tom, welcome to Your Call.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Of course. Go ahead. You're on the air.
I wanted to say that I was a former member of a union. My wife is a current member of a union. She's in. She's a flight attendant. And Sarah Dela Cruz is the head negotiator for her union. The Communication Workers of America are the representatives for United Airlines flight attendants. Extremely ineffective as a negotiator.
And does
in addition, when we have jobs that we have to send out, the workers tend to not be able to do one job. And when we work in schools, convicted felons can't work in schools. And we fill out a DAS 140, which is a requirement for a union worker to come to our jobs. And if they send a convicted felon, I have to turn around and send away. In addition, I have to pay them for the day. It is an extremely difficult position working with the union when we try to work with the union and do the right things. I didn't know if anybody ever represents this to your guests. And it's not that we're anti-union, because obviously we're not.
Tom, hold on for a moment. We'll try to have some dialogue with Jonathan Rosenblum. Jonathan, if you could respond to some of Tom's concerns.
Well, I don't know if I can address your concerns specifically, Tom, as I'm not familiar with your own. I can say two things. One is that unions are made up of people and therefore are imperfect institutions. And the second thing is that unions, the idea of workers standing together and fighting for the things that they need collectively, is the best idea for winning a just society in this country. And so we have to struggle where we find imperfect situations. We have to struggle with our union brothers and sisters to see that we need a different approach, a different way, a different skill set, and so on. But we do that within the union, not by standing outside and critiquing. And I empathize with your situation, and I'd say get involved in the union. I hope your wife gets more involved in her union and makes it a more perfect one.
Tom, did you want to come back?
Yeah, I think you're dancing around an issue, and it's not to be argumentative, but when you have somebody that you know is a convicted felon and you try to send them to a school site when you're warned ahead of time, 72 hours ahead of time, that you're going to be going to a school site with a union worker, it doesn't seem right that it's continually a problem with the people that are sent. And I'm not saying that all union workers are convicted felons, because it's certainly not true. But it is true that there's very little attention paid. It's next one up, next one goes out. And that can't always be, especially when you're working in public works. And as far as the United Airlines contracts, those are horrible. And with the merger with Continental, the negotiations have now taken 4 years. And I have to wonder, how bad a negotiator can one be that takes 4 years from one union to meld with another?
Well, Tom, I think it's going to be difficult for Jonathan to respond to the specifics of either of those questions, but I do appreciate you calling in. And I would just come back to you, Jonathan. So say that, let's take it out of the specific circumstance, but say you're a worker in a union where you really feel like the leadership or the people who are negotiating on your behalf are ineffective or not really paying attention to what it is that your needs are or what you think you and your fellow workers need. How do you try to make change within that institution?
Well, I think you have to identify people you work around who also feel the same way and talk to them and say, we should have something better. Part of the challenge that we have in unions today is that people have low expectations because they see the union as an outside entity, that it's the union staff in the headquarters who are doing this, or it's the union negotiators we just heard. And I think it's true that that unions in many cases have become bureaucratized and therefore very hard to sort of move in a more progressive direction. But that's what we have to do. We have to struggle around this stuff, connect up with other people who find the same way, make sure that unions internally are exercising democracy where people's voices matter, and really stand up and fight for what you believe in within the organization.
Tom, thank you so much for your call. Let's go next to John in San Francisco. John, welcome to your call.
This is the two quick comments. My girlfriend works for SEIU, or it might be SEIU Healthcare Workers West. I'm not sure if they're still fighting. While she and her coworkers enjoy the benefits and the protections of representation, I'm pretty sure there's widespread ignorance of how that came about and how it continues to be. How do you deal with taking these things for granted in the SEIU? And then another general comment. In the trades, it's a complete flip side as far as income. Some of them, like inside wiremen, HVAC, elevator repair, are earning close to or over six figures, and which puts you in the middle class. How do you continue to reach people on that end of the spectrum, especially in light of the culture war that's going on? Just two general comments.
Two really good points there, John. Jonathan, why don't you pick up where you'd like to?
Yeah, let me start with your first question, John. Those are both excellent. And I'd say, you know, how do we not take things for granted? I think we have to remember and teach about our history, not just because it's interesting, but because it informs our struggles today. So today we'll be in the streets celebrating May Day and standing up for immigrant rights. It's important for us to remember this is a holiday that began with a strike in Chicago in 1886 when workers stood up and fought for the eight-hour day. And it wasn't just anybody. It was immigrant workers from Bohemia and Germany who led that fight that started in Chicago and then spread nationally and even internationally. They didn't win 8 hours immediately, but over the course of years and many more struggles, we won the eight-hour workday in this country. Now, there certainly has been slippage in the last few decades, right, because of what the attacks that we've had. But it's important to remember that these struggles were fought for and won. And you know, John, I hear the same thing from people who talk about young workers don't understand that Social Security, where Social Security came from. It didn't come out of the benevolence of the Roosevelt administration or Congress in the 1930s. It came because workers, by the hundreds of thousands, marched and organized and struck and demonstrated and lobbied and did the things that forced the political establishment to recognize we need a retirement program for all Americans. And that's how we've won things in the past, and that's how we're going to win things in the future. Now, in terms of how we reach our brothers and sisters in the trades, I think about it this way. And many, many people maybe who are listening have been involved in campaigns to organize unions in the workplace. And if you haven't, stick with me for a moment, because I think this is pretty intuitive. Whenever workers start to organize in a workplace and the boss starts to fight back, he doesn't go after the strongest, most outspoken people first. He will go after the people he perceives to be the weakest and the most vulnerable, because he knows if he can turn them, then it will shake the confidence of other people. He starts with the weakest, most vulnerable group, and then he'll go to the next weakest and most vulnerable, and the next, and so on, until it's only a small group of workers who are still standing with the union. Well, what we're seeing in America today is an attack on the working class. And the political establishment, led by the Trump administration, but let's not mistake ourselves, it's a wide-ranging political establishment, and their corporate allies have identified immigrants as being potentially the most vulnerable to attack. And so if they can defeat immigrant workers, if they can break them away from the rest of us who are not first-generation immigrants, then it weakens the whole movement. So I would say to the building trades members who are saying, hey, I got mine, I got a good job, I'm not going to worry about the rest of you all, I'd say, your turn is coming. So you better stand with immigrants, because if you don't, you're going to find yourselves under attack very soon. Prevailing wage laws will come under attack. There'll be a promotion of an effort for so-called right to work for less laws in your state, in the country, and so on. That's going to affect your job very directly as well. So when we stand up for immigrant workers, we're actually standing up to create a bulwark against, you know, in support of all of us and everything that we've won over the generations.
That's Jonathan Rosenblum. He is the author of Beyond 15, Immigrant Workers, Faith Activists, and the Revival of the Labor Movement. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number to call is 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Jonathan, I want to ask, just go back to your title of your book, Beyond 15. Obviously, your story in this book talks about how these workers at SeaTac, you know, as you made decisions strategically, you decided to go to try to get a $15 minimum wage plus other elements to that at SeaTac that then became something broader in Seattle and, of course, has had impacts across the United States. And this fight for 15 idea is one, you know, Bernie Sanders and others, Hillary Clinton, put out there. But you do also see real limits to that, and I'm curious about what those limits are, why you think, you know, this can't be kind of the end point, and what you think are the other big ideas that could really drive organizing and bring a lot of people in.
Yeah, well, let's be clear, first of all, that winning 15 here or elsewhere does a couple of things. One is it ameliorates the worst of the crushing poverty that millions of workers face in America today, and that's a good thing when we can move wages up. The second thing is that it builds worker confidence. When we fight and win, it demonstrates to people everywhere that collective action works, and we can take that energy and take that confidence into the next fight. But I think it is important to put this again in context. I gave the example of Alex Hoops, who today, if Alaska hadn't fired him a dozen years ago and his 500 coworkers, he'd be making over probably $30 an hour. And he's at 16 today, which is an improvement over the minimum wage he was making in 2011, but it's still not a living wage. Indeed, if we could somehow get $15 an hour as the national minimum wage passed today, not phased in, but today, I mean, surely a political fantasy, but if you could do that, it would offset only a fraction of the income disparity that has grown in this country just in the 24 months after the official end of the Great Recession in 2009. Wealthy people saw their wealth increase by $6.6 trillion during the 24 months between 2009 and 2011. $15 an hour would only offset a fraction of that. So let's first of all put it in context that we need to aim higher. We need to have bold demands that are not about just making incremental changes, but about what is justice and what do we deserve. And then secondly, we need to reach out and build a broad movement, not just of unions in the workplace, but what I call unions in the community, immigrant rights groups, anti-foreclosure groups, civil rights organizations, faith communities, LGBT groups, and so on. These are all part of what we call the greater labor movement, and we need to engage together as partners. And thirdly, we need to really engage ordinary working people whose wisdom and perseverance can really help inform this struggle and not just imagine that these campaigns get cooked up in campaign rooms of union headquarters, but rather it happens through the engagement of people on the street every day.
Speaking of the engagement of people, we appreciate the engagement of our listeners like Judy, who's calling in from San Francisco. Judy, welcome to your call, and if you could be brief, I'd appreciate it. We're a little short on time.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
I commend everything that your guest has been saying, and my point kind of dovetails with a lot of them. I'm really concerned about the assault on public employee unions. You can still hear me there?
Go ahead.
Okay. I'm concerned with the assault on public employee unions. It began just before Antonin Scalia died. There was a case coming to the Supreme Court, and now there's going to be another one, and Neil Gorsuch will really hammer the public employees, turning their shops from what's called union shops into like right-to-work shops. And the public employees are like the last holdout of, you know, a large sector of good union jobs. Their unions are trying to organize different kinds of workers as well. For example, my union, SEIU, is organizing adjunct professors who are really exploited. if this succeeds, you know, it's going to be a 1-2 punch, because once you've said that it's okay to make public employee shops not union shops where people don't have to pay their dues, then you can say, well, it's fine. Now it's fine. If it's fine for them, it's fine for the rest of the private employees who currently have union status.
Judy, I want to get a response from Jonathan. Thanks so much for the call. Appreciate it, Jonathan.
Well, Judy, thanks very much for raising that. And absolutely, we need to defend the standards that we've won in the public sector. among public service workers throughout this country. But we also need then public service workers also need to recognize that we've got to organize in the private sector as well. You certainly recall that in 2011, halfway across the country in Wisconsin, Governor Scott Walker broke public sector unions. And we can blame people like him, we can blame people like Trump for all they're doing to attack unions and nominate Supreme Court justices who are going to force these open shops. But the truth is that half of the problem came about not because of those people who are occupying power, but also because unions gave up the intention to organize on a broad scale over the last several decades. And we've got to get back to that with a fierce urgency. Scott Walker was only successful because over the years in Wisconsin, private sector unionization had gone way down. Unions had basically given up on organizing in that state. And so that workers in the public arena had much better wages and benefits than their counterparts in the private arena. And using that differential, Walker was able to drive a wedge into the working class. And we can't let that happen again.
So, Jonathan, we got about a minute left. I just follow on that. I mean, there was a very strong response. Obviously, the occupation of the Capitol in Madison in Wisconsin. Why do you think, though, ultimately that movement, which was, you know, it wasn't like they took it sitting down, that was a pretty powerful response, didn't succeed?
It was a very powerful movement, and I wasn't on the ground, so I'm not the expert. But what I can say from a distance is that the key moment came when the union leaders decided to move from a mass-based struggle into the political arena and said, let's do a recall election. Instead of using the power of people in the streets, the power of tens of thousands of people occupying Madison, they said, let's move this into the electoral arena. And that's when the energy went away, because the power actually was in being able to disrupt and shut down state government. And if they had continued on that trajectory, we might be in a different situation today.
Jonathan Rosenblum, I want to thank you so much for joining us today on Your Call. Really appreciate you taking the time. And this book, Beyond 15, Immigrant Workers, Faith Activists, and the Revival of the Labor Movement, just out now from Beacon Press. Thanks so much, Jonathan.
Thank you. See you in the streets.
All right. Have a great May Day. Jonathan will be discussing his book at UC Berkeley at their Labor Center on Thursday, May 11th at 6 p.m. For more information, you can check out our website, yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. Thanks for everyone who called and emailed. Your Call is produced at KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Maliha Razazan produced today's show. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. And I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, who will return tomorrow.